Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the dough and dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
This is Jason Horsley, this is The Limitless, the podcast in between. I'm just waiting for Alejandro Martinez Gallardo to call me on Skype. I'm going to talk to him today, it's Tuesday the 10th of February 2015, about Pajama Surf, the website that he runs with Javier Barros del V and others. Pajama Surf is a website that I've been writing for on and off since 2011.
Alejandro.
Hola, Alejandro. ¿Qué tal?
Todo bien.
What I thought for today, just to begin anyway, I thought we could focus on you. Rather than on me, and I just want to ask you a little bit about what you're doing with Pajama Surf and how that's going, and you can fill me in because stuff I'm curious about too.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, we can speak about Pajama Surf and whatever you want to ask him. And I'm also like in a stage of liminality when I told you know about the being a bit sick, and what I've been reading it's sort of had a synchronicity type of relationship with my own like mind state and sickness, and my readings have sort of like given me this sort of echo of the mind in reality and making me sort of understand this process, you know, in a different way. So that can also be.
What particularly have you been reading?
Well, I started reading James Hillman, and I've never approached his work, but I've heard a lot of it, and it came strangely, you know. I was looking to buy this book, and I didn't know which one to buy, and I bought one that's called A Blue Fire, you know, and this book is a book like it's like an introduction to Hillman's work, and it's written by this guy that that learned with Hillman and was called Thomas More, and I had this like strange mantra when I was growing up, and I always said like el fuego es azul, like fire is blue, and that's what like at the end in this like whim of it made me buy that book, and when I bought it, it's like it has. Sort of a recopilation of all of Hillman's work, so it's a very synthetic and packed information dense book, and it reflected exactly what like I needed to hear or in a way wanted to hear of what a stage of when you're sick and sort of have like a midlife crisis or Terry's crisis what might mean, and obviously it fits great to what's happening to me. So in that sense, I might be projecting this meaning, but it is very interesting that it says that or starts to dwell on the idea of soul or of the soul sort of finding itself through sickness and pathologizing as a way that the soul or the psyche has to like face itself or make itself go clear in one way that it cannot sort of betray itself. Like it connects to this idea of the Platonic daimon or the sort of that you are born with a guardian spirit, and that guardian spirit is in a way responsible of your vocation or your life work. So it kind of pushes you or nudges you into what you sort of have as fate or as a kind of destiny to do, you know? And so that feels very nice to my narrative, or as I think that in a way I was like straying or neglecting my soul's call or whatever, which was more of an artistic and more of a writing things that I really care of, meaningful. And this also with Pyjama Surf, which were in a way this kind of straight, and we might have been doing a lot of things more commercially or not thinking about the deeper meaning of things, no? So kind
of that. Well, I don't know if you know this, you might have picked it up similar in a lot of way, but I've suffered from a physical ailment that can be diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome.
Oh yeah, do you know who? This writer called Howard Bloom. Yeah. He wrote Global Brain. He has that too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it came out when I was in Mexico. I seem to remember we talked a bit about it in that restaurant or that kebab, yeah, whatever that place was we went. But certainly, yeah, what you're describing speaks to my experience. And there's various angles that you can come at this, what you're describing, but one of the simplest is something an astrologer said to me about the chronic fatigue, that it's looked at through an astrological lens as a bit like what you're saying, like a pathfinder, like when a person isn't on the path, when they're not actually acting and embodying the forces, the psychic energies that need to be embodied and acted out, then the body, you know, it reacts, it suffers as a result of that. So it's the idea that the body is a barometer, that it measures not just our external environment, which obviously it does, the temperature and the air pressure and all the rest of it, the body's constantly monitoring those things and adjusting to them, but also the internal environment, which actually, funny enough, predictably enough, relates to autism and how autists, there are some autistic people, people on the spectrum, who can't lie because of the amount of stress it causes them in their bodies, like they actually, it causes them physical pain when they tell a lie.
Yeah, I can relate to that, and yeah, I see that also. And what amazes me is it is also a way that you like know or experiment truly that your psyche or your soul or whatever does manifest in reality in the material world, because the body, it becomes like such of a vessel of these inner feelings, no, or of these like inner trials. So in a way, it also, I mean, I always like dwelled on this concept of mind versus matter, and it all sounded really interesting. And I've had like spiritual experiences and all that, but until this time, when you kind of when you analyze yourself and you think of what's going on, and you come to the realization, yeah, that disease or sickness or what's happening or like in my relationships or whatever is a result of my inner process of the depth of my psyche, then you see the world well differently, you know, because it also erases the barrier between the inner and the outer, no, as within so without and vice versa, no. Mm-hmm. So it does have some powerful philosophical and psychological things, no, and that's why right now I'm really into this Hillman's work, because it exactly mirrors what I've been passing, and that is what is psychological, no. Psychological means of the soul, really. Yeah. No? So this is I think I was like neglecting my soul part, no, and.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty general now. I mean, as I often find, or I found, speaking with people who aren't versed in psychology, when I talk about the psyche, they think that I'm talking about the mind, and they say, yes. No, it's not about the mind, it's about the soul. And I'm like, well, no, actually, the psyche is the soul. I mean, they're synonymous. But so in the West, it's like... I think that our experience, and it isn't really an experience, it's a surrogate, I would say, but the way that we try and experience spiritual truth or our soul is through the mind. And in fact, I would say that we really can't experience spiritual reality, not a term I use very easily, feeling a bit uncomfortable in my body there because it sounds kind of meaningless, but the depths of one's being, one's soul, one's psyche, you can't actually experience it through the mind, because the mind, it seems to me, is the defense against that.
Yeah, it's the ego, no, and the psyche is in another realm. No, it's like the underworld. Well, the underworld is another realm. It's not this realm. So they're different things, no?
Right, but the body, on the other hand, is constantly in tune and trying to get more in tune with the psyche. And again, this is the mind-body duality is creating this problem where we can actually take refuge in the mind and live in the mind. It is possible, and even kind of sanctioned in our culture, is to have a life of the mind. But the cost of that is that all one's attention is on one's thoughts, even if they're creative and really inspired, and one's having spiritual visions of other dimensions and other galaxies, and who knows what all. You know, I've certainly had my share of those things. But the simple kind of baseline awareness of one's physical, the sensation of actually physically being here, externally, you know, the environment, the way it's affecting the body, but also internally, that experience gets completely flooded out because it's such a subtle signal.
Yeah, I think also the body becomes deeper than the mind, no? And becomes more of a way to feel what is invisible for the mind. And also I think we live in this paradigm of ego. So ego is it's growing, you know. It's this like go to the mountains and grow and have developmental experiences and the light of reality of, you know, and this all like positivistic affirmations of ego. And the soul, sometimes it's more of, it can also be related more to deeper, darker things, no? And we run away from dark things or depressive things as things that should be avoided. But this depressive aspect of reality, this darkness, this going into the deep end, is part of what's the soul making quality of life, no? So I mean, in a way, ego is what it's completely like what makes us forget the soul and sort of posits this sort of enchantment or illusory, like, I don't know. So it's not like the ego is the enemy completely, but, you know, it's we live too much in that kind of reality, I think.
Well, depression is certainly something I think about a lot. I mean, because I have a natural tendency towards depression, or what we call depression. So I would say, you know, in that framework, using that term, that I've been kind of existed at a low level depression my whole life. Like, that's just my standard default setting. But on the other hand, I mean, what you're saying, I agree that depression is not all bad, and it's not at all what it seems. So we have this word for something, and with the word, it's a diagnosis, right? If you're depressed, that's a diagnosis. It's not a process. The very word itself suggests, because of the baggage it carries anyway, it's something you've got to fix, you've got to address. You don't want to be depressed. It interferes, like my chronic fatigue. It prevents us from achieving, from being good Western achievers, right?
Yeah.
And there's even an element of sort of self-indulgence. I mean, I know when I'm depressed, I feel guilty or ashamed, or I feel as though it means I'm getting it wrong somehow, like I must be doing something wrong, otherwise I wouldn't be depressed, and that makes me more depressed. And that's wrong thinking, as I'm sure that's what you're expressing, what you'd be reading in Hillman and other deep psychologists, that depression is... I mean, there's various things going on there. One of them is simply facing up to the facts. Right? The facts are depressing to the ego.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I don't know. I don't think that one should stay depressed the whole life, because that again would be kind of like a misleading the soul's like actual work. But then again, depression or other kind of illness or psychopathologies are also symptoms of something deeper, and we react to symptoms as something that we must initially and instantly extirpate, no, and block and avoid. And if we do that, we don't receive the actual message of the situation, no? I mean, there is a reason, a deeper reason we are depressed, no? There's a deeper reason why I'm sick of my stomach or whatever. And if I take farms quickly, and I might not actually experience this deep message, no? As I wrote to you, I was also, like, approaching this medicine called the Unani, that's like from the Greco-Arab tradition, goes back to Hippocrates. And they say, they have this idea that sicknesses or diseases are like messengers of God, and they are like the opportunities for kind of the revelation of deeper communications, no? And that also relates kind of to, I think, to shamans and in other cultures where they sometimes could be schizophrenic or psychotic or whatever, but then they might actually come out of it as shamans that can bridge worlds. And if you start to medicate these kind of liminality experiences or liminal experiences, then you might not like grow what, or well, not grow, but understand, no? Understand what happens, what is going on, no?
Yeah, well, there's the well-known whatever you want to call it, the axiom or the platitude about a cup needs to be emptied before it can be filled, and it seems, I mean, the sense I'm getting as I grow older and face the facts of my own life and why I've had chronic fatigue and why I've been low-level depressed my whole life has to do with the either one's body is occupied by one's thoughts or by one's psyche, or perhaps to put it better, one's psyche can't actually come into embodiment, one's soul can't land in the body, as long as one's body has been actually co-opted by one's thoughts. And I see thoughts, I experience them as actual kind of like tentacles in the matrix or something that actually enter into our body. I think they create a web around us, like this energetic web, because when we think, it's an energy, you know? There's an energy of creative consciousness, and thought may be the lowest expression of that, but it's still, when we have a thought, it's out there, it exists, it never goes away again. Well, maybe we can erase it, that's another sort of variation of this, but certainly until we address it, reintegrate it, and allow it to be dissolved back into undifferentiated consciousness, that those thoughts exist, and they create these clusters that are around us, like this cloud around us wherever we go, but also more, perhaps more critically, they get kind of embedded in the body, like under the skin and in the veins and in the cells. It's very weird. It's like cancer would be, you know, that's when it really metastasizes, when those thought clusters become so concentrated that the cells actually start to imitate the clusters, and then that is like ego embodied, kind of, or coagulated ego. This is a bit controversial, because then it makes, you don't want to end up blaming the cancer victim. But anyway, I've crossed the line. I crossed back over it. But that's, I mean, that, I haven't had cancer. My mother did, and I felt I did see it to some extent in her. But just keeping it in the realm of chronic fatigue anyway, I do experience these thoughts as something that actually embed themselves in my body and prevent the soul consciousness from... It doesn't even want, you know, the soul doesn't want to come into the body because it becomes so uncomfortable there.
Well, yeah, the Buddhists have the concept of tulpas, and no, and the tulpas are, you know, like psychic entities, and yeah, or egregors, no, and it's fascinating and worrisome. No, I mean I too experienced it. I think that everything you think might be used against yourself or might be a burden. No, and we are creating realities, and fantasy creates reality. That's Jung said that. No, I mean, and it's hard to live with that. And at the same time, I don't know. Perhaps we shouldn't worry so much about our thoughts. And I don't know what would you think about that? Should we think less and more like connect to the body more like perhaps like work in a different realm, more not in thought realm more, but more in a deeper instinctual or perhaps imagination. No, imagination. It's not necessarily thought, no? The imagination used to be considered an organ of perception, of a bridge between worlds, no? Between the world of spirit and this world, or between the angelic and this world. Yeah. And it's a way of perceiving through images, not necessarily thoughts. Right. You know, perhaps, but I think we're very, very programmed or used to relating through thought, no? I think, therefore I exist, no? And so we are very like culturally enslaved in that way of thought, and as you say, thought is sort of a poisonous. It could be a poison, no?
Yeah, I think it's the apple in the garden in that metaphor, right? Because the knowledge of good and evil, and that's a language is all polarity based. I mean, the whole possibility of an interpretation system that's based on good versus evil is dependent on language, I think, and even in a sense an ego seems to me to be a language construct, like a program, like a computer program in our heads. And these are the kind of thoughts that on the one hand I'm saying they're a problem, but on the other hand, as you rightly point out, you can worry too much about them, and you can't fix thinking with thought, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like, well, how much energy do you give your thoughts? Like just this morning I was feeling suicidal. I perhaps shouldn't say feeling, I was thinking suicidal, I was having suicidal thoughts. And that's not particularly rare for me, it's not that common, but it's something throughout my life. I will get to a certain place where I start thinking about suicide, not in a visual sense of, oh, I'll do it this way, or imagining myself doing it, but just it's and actually I was having this quite acutely last night. I was waking up in the night angry, and for whatever reason, and I noticed how, because I couldn't act out my anger because I was just lying there trying to get back to sleep, I was shouting in my head. I was going, fucking fuck this, fuck that, whatever it was. And I realized, oh, that's the only thing I can do to feel powerful, right, is just keep this negative thought narrative going, you know, like a bad Hollywood movie in which I get to kill everyone and everything that is in my way, you know. And that, I think being able to see that and laugh at it, or at least recognize it as not oneself, just at least having that space between one's internal dialogue and one's awareness, so one isn't completely and utterly identified with the internal dialogue, I think that's all that it takes to actually de-energize the thoughts. And they will continue. I mean, they may continue forever, you know, who knows, like as far as whether they even stop with so-called enlightenment or total embodiment. It may be that the mind just still grinds on. It's just that we can choose not to, like a TV, we can just turn away. We can't turn it off. But so it's not quite like a TV, but, you know, like a TV in a bar, it's, you've got no control, but you can just move your seat around and just pretend it's not there, I think would be probably the best we can hope for with the mind.
It's the interesting point there, you know, that thoughts are not yourself necessarily, you know. Thoughts come of the world more, no, and from the environment, and I mean they can be thought like also like as environmental toxins or whatever, no, or not necessarily in a bad way, but they are part of the sphere of communication, technology, morphogenetic fields, and they're sort of the way that we relate to the world, but so not identifying with them is an interesting way of living, and also of what we said, not worrying, because you might be channeling thoughts or thoughts will always run through you. But if they can run their way and not identifying, well, probably they might not sort of metastasize or yeah, become tumors, no? Because if it's flowing, no, if it's always flowing, and in the same time that flow might also sort of free up, so other kind of information can flow through you. Maybe some like cosmic information, some soul. Things you need to communicate, things you need to say, sort of the daimonic or the inner genius things. So the body can be just like this vessel, no? I don't know.
Well, I think the body is, it is a transmitter. It's a receiver transmitter, but I think what you're describing, makes me think of. There's this tendency, and this is the mind again, that I'm a transmitter, I want to tune to the higher dimensions, so we want to start tuning Sirius right away, but of course, like a tree, if you want the fruit, if you want to tune to the higher dimensions, you've got to get your roots down in the lower. I'm actually repeating my oldest line now, it's been a while, but anyway, it's come back to me spontaneously, growing downward. But in terms of the body, I mean, the body is transmitting to us all kinds of information right now as we're talking, and although some of it may be trying to come through from Sirius or beyond, there's an enormous amount of content that simply is coming from the body itself. It doesn't have to come from outside the body, like the blood is carrying information, like ancestral information, that's not coming from outside, that's a biggie. I think connecting to ancestors is obviously it's an old tradition, and we don't have it in the West. I was just having this experience last night of needing to connect. Most of my family, my close family, is dead now. Most of them, so we could say that's, if this isn't too callous, that's kind of an advantage in terms of connecting to my ancestors, because I have this strong emotional connection to some of them, you know, who have passed over already, my mother, my brother, and not so much my father, but because I didn't have a strong connection to him, but still, I mean, you're talking about that, that's my the system that my psyche formed within, but that's also ancestral. Now that they've passed on, they're with the ancestors in some sense, so by connecting to them, potentially I'm connecting to this whole ancestral lineage, whatever that means, I don't really know, but for me it's really a necessary way to actually open up the heart, like emotionally, and that I think is key to opening up the body. Like, I think probably the thing that's strongest within us to override our mental self-punishment system, which is really what it is, the mind, it's a self-defense that becomes self-punishing. And there's no one to defend against, you know, we just attack ourselves. And, but the heart, you know, a real deep heart connection to others, and the feeling of love and of loss also is strong enough to flood out the mind completely. I mean, if somebody's dying before your eyes, you're not judging yourself, you're not following that narrative, you're kind of torn into the present moment.
Yeah, I think there the key is rooting and death itself, no? I mean,
rooting in death, did you say?
Yeah, rooting and death, dying or seeing death in life, no? I think we have sort of taking the dead aspect of life to the back, no, and hidden it, and all of our culture is sort of afraid or traumatized or searches to not see ever death, no? That is completely invisible. Like other cultures used to live with that, and people would have relationships to death. And now, I mean, most people don't grow and they never see death or one of its aspects, no? Not necessarily the dead body in the street or whatever, but I mean, I think that is kind of what grounds us, no? What grounds us and balances out the movement of the ego that is always like going up into the sky, you know, yeah. Or wanting to go into the heroic archetypes and the sun, no? The ego. And this is more of an earthly thing and going down and I mean, I think it's strangely what I have like in intuitively thought of is that kind of what can heal a sickness is death itself, no? I mean, and knowing that and understanding that and sort of making peace with death, and because it also it works out this idea of not identifying too much with what's happening, no? Because you're gonna die. It's the impermanence aspect, so I kind of think that death should be therapy. You know, it's a therapeutic aspect.
Well, as I was saying, the ego finds the facts of life really depressing, because the facts of life are that everything dies, and that's the fundamental fact of life, really. Yeah, that's just what you're saying. Like all the best laid plans of mice and men, except that men have bigger egos than mice, they are reduced to nothing. I mean, and it's, I don't know, I mean, I can only speak personally because it's a cliche otherwise, and it's well known, you know, use death as an advisor, but it's just an idea. And for me, it took getting old enough to really, I mean, because I'm almost 50 now, and although my body's not breaking down as yet, in fact, I probably feel better in my body than at any other time in life, rather tragically, just as it is starting to wear down. But anyway, my awareness of death is becoming much less academic, you know, or theoretical. It's becoming really experiential, just the knowing, and there's just the feeling of being on this fast track towards the end. And you know, I'm always wary of philosophies that transcend death, but at the same time I feel quite sure that death is not the end. I kind of know that, some part of me knows that, even though I'm sure it's the end of the ego. I hope it's the end of the ego.
Yeah.
So it's kind of it's like a tightrope walking thing. It's like, because we don't want to, I mean, you were talking about the imagination earlier, and I read about this in Seen and Not Seen, how Steiner talks about this myth of Lucifer and how Lucifer took away man's vision in order to give him free will, because when man had vision, he could see the movements of the divine forces, and so he didn't even have any choice. I mean, there was no idea of choice. He simply went along with the movement of the divine. So he was just part of everything because he could see the interconnections of everything. So there was no way to even imagine that we were separate. So Lucifer came in and he said, no, man should be free to actually choose. And so he blinded man so that he would be free. He would have this illusion that he was separate from the divine forces. And as compensation, he gave man the gift of the imagination. And the purpose of the imagination was not to create fantasy worlds, as you were talking about earlier, but to be able to, it's like what we call intuition, actually, was what once upon a time, the imagination and the intuition, well, the imagination was the way that we would develop into it. I don't even know how to put it into words, but the point was is that we were supposed to imagine the divine forces to the extent that we could then actually go along with them without being able to see them, but we would discover that they were real somehow through the act of imagination.
And the imagination is, in certain traditions, the eye of the heart, no? So it's more of a, also, as you say, an intuitive quality, not necessarily like the third eye, you know, as some say, but more the heart and seeing with depth, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole body, even. I mean, the heart is the center of the body, and the heart has its neural network and everything.
Yeah.
And Native Americans talk about the heart as where consciousness is centered, some of them anyway. And I would definitely go along with that. Like, my experiences of being really close to the core of myself or reality have been heart-centered. They haven't been in the head.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is also what I've, like, kind of struggled all my life. And now, you know, I'm 33. And I had a like relatively healthy life, but I used psychedelics and stuff like that, and suddenly it stopped. No, this kind of obviously now in retrospectively there are signs that these things could be going on, but it was a pretty radical change, no, in health wise. But it also made me reflect. It made me more reflective and analyze my life and see it as patterns and everything. And I think one of the keys that perhaps made me pathologize was this aspect of not seeing through the heart, or of being very mental, very more lofty or airy and less earth, no? Or more of a mercurial, but less... I have less... of a Saturn way, no, and now I'm more in the Saturn aspect, which is obviously related to sickness, but also to earth and grounding and growing old and this aspect. And I think kind of what made me this is not being able to sort of connect with more of the heart aspect and the more of the thymus, the blood, the this emotional quality of life, and it starts to make sense that all these elucubrations of the mind are more illusions, no, and things that you project, and what's more important is more grounding and heart soulful things, which is pretty obvious, no? But one can grow and live in fantasy and not reflect upon this, no? So sometimes it sort of hits you, slaps back, no? And I think that's what happened.
See, this is not somebody that I particularly admire, but you know, Aldous Huxley, one of the things he said very later in life, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, it's rather embarrassing to realize at my age that the only thing that really matters is simply being kinder to people.
Yeah.
For all his, you know, because he spent a life of intellectual inquiry and searching and analysis, and apparently at the end of it he decided that the only thing that really made a difference was just being a little bit kinder and more compassionate to other people.
Yeah, and understanding that service... No, servicing others, and again we come back to the ego. That's the essential trap of the ego that wants to feed itself all the time. No, and it's hard for me. It was a bit hard. I'm lonely. I'm a only child. I said lonely, which is also it's also true. And then you do kind of see the world through a glass that is completely individualistic. And I think the individual, it's sort of an invention of culture, which is different than saying that we should not individuate, no, or the Jungian sense, but the individual as a as a being that is like enclosed in his own ego and exists separately and has to grow and sort of take from the world and feed itself so it can become heroic or whatever, or satisfy its own desires. That is sort of a great, one of the great illusions of our time, no? We are more constructed socially than I mean, we're truly socially. I think these metaphors of humans as cells in a larger network and stuff like that, at least biologically, it makes much more sense, no? Biologically, of course, then you can think about the individual soul, and that is also true. But we are constructed socially, you know, and that's why one of the most important factors in health is your relationships. People that have intimate relationships are much more healthier, no? Because we're like an immune cell, no? In a larger body. Yeah. So.
It's one of my motivations for taking up the podcast again, actually. And there were various conscious ones, and of course, can't speak about the unconscious ones, but one of the main ones is just recognizing that connecting to others as frequently and as authentically or as meaningfully as possible is absolutely essential, you know, to my own well-being. And I think it's, you know, as within, as without, that connecting internally to one's inner space, that's also a system. You could call it social if you want. To me, the word social has certain meanings because it relates to, you know, that there are social systems that are set up and they're perhaps not really, they're not actually very social, if you know what I mean. Just the civilization isn't very civilized.
Like social networks, you know, they're not.
Yeah, or just like society, really. I mean, the whole of society is kind of hierarchical, and that is not the kind of system, like the body that we need to belong to. It's comunitas is the word I discovered through liminality, is the kind of social arrangement that arises in a liminal state. It has to keep transforming, so whether you can sustain it, I think it does depend on this inner, the individuation, as you say, which is, I think, allowing one's consciousness to be in service to or serving the inner realm. And the inner realm is, well, it is the realm of the soul, and I think the soul is part of a network too, like there are no individual souls really, but also just in a very basic sense, like the internal organs, the whole inner world of the body is this great system. It's not a hierarchy, but it's all these interconnecting organs and cells. It's a multiplicity. And it's all aware, I'm sure of that. Like the heart's aware, the guts are aware, the brain's aware, the muscles are aware, you know, the genitals are aware, the cells, you know, even atoms carry information. And even physicists are talking about atoms as actually having some rudimentary self-awareness, some of them are. So if you think of the body as this multiplicity of awarenesses, which are, they're both discrete and individual and not, like fingers on the hand, you know, from one point of view they do have some sort of individual existence, but not, it can't ever be separated from the system, unlike the ego, the internal narrative self, which is fictional, therefore can create any kind of false reality in which to exist.
Yeah, I think what struck me with what you said is connecting to ourselves is connecting to multiplicity. We are immanently a collective. We're a community inside too. No, we're filled with millions of cells that are related, and some of those cells, most of them are bacteria and virus, and everything is embedded in different networks. No, so, and we can also think of the self as community, as we are different archetypes. We are different, as they say, we are many gods. No, or we're the psyche is polytheistic, or and perhaps when we die, we become many too, no? And this approach of consciousness as many, not as individuals only, no? And that for me is beautiful, and it's something that I'm starting to also become more aware, no? of this inner community and the true nature of being in networks and in different aspects. I mean, as you said, we are starting to know that the cells are cell intelligence. No, there the cells might be intelligent beings, no, on their own, I mean, and they're working together. No, so again,
why can't we?
Yeah, exactly. That it sounds like a cheap phrase. Yeah,
that's a song, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. And have this consciousness of the communitas, and I don't know, take it from there. You know? Staying in being and not in becoming, you know? Like we always are trying to become something or change things, and perhaps being more comfortable in the realm of being and seeing things just like as they are, even not trying to heal. That is something that for me it's a struggle. Not trying to heal or not trying to do this epic thing of healing. It's okay to be sick, you know? I mean, and maybe you cannot even change it. It's so that also with the world too, but becoming like more peaceful and understanding, you know? Which means to stand under, you know? So perhaps through this standing under, you know? That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with all that, and I was wondering then, why am I talking about comunitas? Because that creates this idea that there's a better way to live. And I'm, as you may have picked up, I'm really opposed to trying to bring solutions, because I think that they just create more problems. I think all the problems we have are the result of people trying to solve previous problems. And so yeah, just to be in what is, but and accept it. But then to accept it, to accept the situation as is means seeing it. I'm not even sure if understanding is even possible, but standing under, as in kind of submitting to it and getting deep, you know, to that low point where you can see the whole of it, like Jonah in the belly of the whale, maybe something like that, letting it swallow you up. Certainly at an individual level, that's depression, like letting one's patterns take one over, not to the point of acting them out, because then you spread it, you know, you aggravate it and make it worse. But in a psychic way, letting one's awareness be completely taken over by the discomfort, the rage, or the frustration, or the despair, or whatever it is, rather than running around trying to cope and trying to find solutions, or dropping, you know, medication or psychedelics or reading this book or that book. Certainly, an individual level, I think, yeah, what works best is nothing, doing nothing, and collectively too. So then, but then, to really experience the situation, I don't even want to call it a problem, but what we think of as a problem, means, I mean, there is something in that, like exploring a problem without having an eye towards a solution is a way to fully experience it.
Yeah, I think, and in a way, it's like to operate in that sort of a deeper level of doing without doing, although there are a lot of things, and one of the things that makes it difficult is the world itself, no? The cultural programming and the noise, no, like the noisy world we inhabit. So it's kind of paradoxical, but.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I feel obviously need to say the same way about the world in quotes, but I have to put it in quotes because, you know, what is the world really? It's a sort of false collective or an imaginary collective, because the world is this temporary structure within the universe. Not that the universe isn't temporary, but it's a social arrangement. But to a large part, it's mass media. Like how I experience the world, in quotes, is through the mass media, which I don't expose myself to very much. But even just being on Twitter and whatnot, you pick up stuff and you get a sense of what people are talking about and what the general opinion is, what you can say without being condemned, kind of thing. To get a sense of what the social group is doing and whether you can get with it. And yes, I feel an increased isolation from that, I would say. It's not decreasing through individuation. I think individuation is a kind of voluntary alienation to a large extent from this supposed the world. But in terms of individuals, which is really what I experience, something else seems to be happening. Like when I relate to you, and that, I mean, that, I would say that's my concern. Like I'm having a conversation with you. It doesn't matter what the world's doing and what's going on in the world, except so far as you or I bring that stuff into this space, you know, our own patterning and conditioning and expectations, and therefore close the space down, you know, with those ideas and those preconceptions.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I do think I agree. I mean, we are kind of locked in the world, and the world, what we mean by world is obviously a fantasy and a sort of a collective hallucination, no? I don't know. I mean, I think I lost a little bit track there, but
that's all right. At least you said it. Are you getting a vision? Not a vision. That would be too highfalutin. An image. Not even really an image. While we were talking of this, like us in this world of meaningless connections and you know, noise, trying to find the signal. That it's kind of like this, like Neo in the Matrix. You know, we're in this dream state, and it's actually, you know, this generated reality through projections from the past. I'm not sure I can put it into words, but it's like what we're actually doing here isn't what it seems. We're not here for a worldly purpose. We're not here to leave a mark on the world or to get something from the world. We're here to actually find one another. Like there's, I don't want to say too much, but I'm already on the edge of it. But I think there's very, very few of us here who, I don't want to know how to finish that sentence, but let's just say for me, there's very few people out there that I need or want to connect to. So it's a question of finding you and connecting to you, and that those connections create a world. World.
I think that seems, I can relate to that. And there is a beautiful aspect of that in the sense that, I mean, there's this poem by, well, this letter, I think, John Keats, that says that, the world is the valley of, or the veil of soul making, no? Mm-hmm. And we like make the soul through others, no? And other people that we have like this like kind of deep connection and deep meaning, sort of they are images of our soul, and through them we find ourselves and we kind of weave together our meaning, no? Our way in life, and other people many times are mentors, and they reveal this our own soul. No, some people can see your soul, mm-hmm. and sometimes you need people to see you as you are, so you can see yourself. These are the most beautiful things. And I also don't think there is a deeper meaning in the world than or in life than these moments where when you really connect to other people and they make you well make you make they make beauty they make beauty like live, no? They reveal in this world like the other world too, or the divine, or the soul. You know, they are like connectors between the invisible and the visible. And it's hard to think of something more beautiful and meaningful than this kind of aspect of meaningful experience, but through others, no? Through what others can make you see yourself, and because this also makes leads us to the idea that it's through the many that we find the one, no? And that's a really, really interesting thing.
Yeah, it's a big paradox that one only has a sense of existing through, as an individual, through somehow disappearing into a group.
Yeah, and I do feel a lot of isolation, no? I also I share your interest in like doing this podcast and trying to connect with the world or with others, and because in this like process of introspection and working on your own and sort of depressive and being sick and it does cut out these kind of experiences, and also it makes you like in a defensive mood, no? So you don't want to go to the world or go to these situations because you might get hurt or you might get contaminated because there is this kind of toxic environment, no? But at the same time, that is also what makes you more soulful or makes possible this kind of meaningful events. And so I think it's important to find like this middle path of knowing when to retreat, sort of like perhaps follow the seasons, no? Like in your own inner winter, go down and sleep and don't connect so much. And when it's time, like kind of do it. Because it is important. Even though we might get I sometimes get this delusion that I am enough for myself and I can do bright things by myself and write and whatever and not have this more emotional, humane sort of blood and flesh contact, which is probably replaceable. And that's one of the big things that's happening with social media, no? And with the virtual sphere that it's doing a sort of a cheap simulation, a cheap substitution of this irreplaceable contact, which is human, but it is also what makes us like realize the divine aspect of things.
Well, I think that we are changing and mutating, however, and I think that like the medium, and the medium doesn't necessarily limit the depth of connection. Like you and I have met, which is good, definitely. I think being fully rounded, perhaps, is what I'm getting from what you're saying, and it's not so much about one thing being better than another, but just allowing oneself to experience all these things. So yeah, there's a time to be isolate and introspective and even depressed, in quotations, to have that experience of inner disintegration. And then there are times to come out and be with one's physical flesh and blood and community. And that, but we have this wonderful kind of intermediary liminal space that you and I are in now, where, I don't know about you, but I'm alone, I'm up in the attic. I'm kind of experiencing a solitary experience, and yet I'm connecting to somebody else. So there's something beautiful about that. That's relatively new.
You know, yeah, I'm completely isolated too. I'm like near the mountain, and there's, I mean, the some guy that works the fields here came about, but there's nobody in the perimeter too.
Yeah, and so I mean that does allow for a bridging internally and externally, because, for example, if I was quite depressed, let's say, I probably wouldn't go out and hang out with people, even if I did that where I live, which I hardly do, but I might connect somebody on Skype because it's safer. So it's like we're, you know, these fledgling creatures that are just struggling out of the shell and taking steps outside the nest. It is very frightening and very vulnerable when the ego starts disintegrating and the psyche starts coming into the body. It's super, one becomes super sensitized, you know, this idea that we would become more and more powerful and invulnerable and above it all is, you know, just the mind fantasy. It's actually, in my experience so far, it's the opposite. Become much more tenderized and vulnerable. And so to be able to have this bridge where we can take steps towards the community or comunitas, even while we just want to hide away and withdraw, not to force ourselves, but at least to have that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think, yeah, in that way, as you said, yeah, I mean, technology, this kind of communication matrix does make that able, and in that way, that's pretty cool. And there are a lot of great uses, no? I mean, this, I mean, the power of, like, the hermetic, mercurial power of communication in this age is amazing. And, I mean, in my life, one of the best things I've done have become part because of the internet and everything. But it's as I say that I'm also aware now, like how this kind of the framework, like the medium, it also affects my mind, you know? And so it's a give and take thing the kind of like the multitasking aspect of the internet and like the constant stimuli, you know, this like releases dopamine and it does, if you don't approach this like in a conscious way, you start like losing your ability to concentrate or to direct your attention. So those aspects, I mean, it's like another subject, but they are also worth reflecting upon, no? Because we it's like McLuhan said. I mean, we get into the environment of the media environment, but we don't know like their hidden effects until later. No, we all adopt these like flashy candy of technological goodies, and then we start to realize that they also have some amputation effects, which part of it. I mean, it's inevitable too, but then, I mean, being aware of it might do difference. Like, right, like when I'm like now when I'm like trying to write something, I just try to shut off all the other Facebook, Twitter, whatever things, all the pinging and when I'm reading some article, not do it halfway, but try to do it full way, not try to, like, I don't know, like, cultivate your own memory and concentration, which is being flooded and invaded by distractions now. Yeah,
this actually is a whole other subject, because I've been reading about this and multiplicity and how we're becoming this we as opposed to an I, you know, our experience of ourselves is becoming a multiplicity through this technology, because of just what you're describing, that our awareness is no longer contained in our own heads. So I think that invasion that you're talking about is as destructive or as distracting, isn't strong enough a word, but, you know, as sabotaging as it can be, and I think it generally is, I think it also, like everything, like homeopathy, you know, the poison in the right dose is potentially transforming our consciousness as individuals.
Yeah, that's a good take too. No, I mean, and I'm all for the we aspect of it. No, and I mean, if you dissolve in the we, that's good. And I mean, I'm willing to sacrifice like some like a sort of neurons for that. You know, but I mean, it's a really big subject. Also, there's like this kind of of thing of, you know, like, well, Roshkoff's thing of being in the present constantly, but being in multiple presents, so really not being in anywhere. No, like, I mean, we might become many, but will we be like really one, or just like fragments without really any integration, any consciousness? It's really a good question.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your prey. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spilled when his world came tumbling down. Comes the monkey, speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling.